Third house is Mildred Fish Harnack, Professor of Philosophy, and Carol Dixon Basco, Professor of the Humanities at UW-Madison, where he has taught for 28 years. He is the recent author of Family Values, The Ethics of Parent-Child Relationships and Educational Goods, Values and Evidence in Decision-Making. Let's give it up for Professor Harry Brickhouse.
Thank you, and thank you for coming on on our first really, really nice day. I'm really glad that you decided to come and spend your time in a room without windows. I'm impressed. So the talk I'm going to give doesn't really contain an argument, which, you know, philosophers, that's what they do, is they give arguments. And I'm not really going to do that. I'll tell you about a couple of arguments, which I rather like. It's more of an autobiographical sketch on the topic of the title. Many of you will recognize it's a tribute of sorts to Bertrand Russell's famous essay, but it has a twist to it. So I'm not a Christian, not exactly, and I'll try and explain why I'm not, but also why it's a little misleading to say that I'm not. So I've got a few stories, and I'll start with a couple of stories about students. So this is a story about an evangelical Christian student who took some of my classes. She graduated in 2007, and like lots of students, she came to me toward the end of college and sort of, well, what am I going to do? You know, I don't really know what profession I have. She wanted to go to law school, not that keen on that, frankly. But and I said, well, you know, why don't you become a pastor? And she looked at me and she said, I didn't come here to become a pastor. You should become a pastor, which seemed a bit passive aggressive. And I said, Lindsay, I lack one crucial qualification for being a pastor. And she said, oh, no, I'm sure lots of pastors don't believe in God. And anyway, if you became a pastor, maybe you would believe in God. I thought, well, that's like, you know, she's really an evangelical. She wants to spread the word. And so the second story is very recent. It's about a student who just graduated, and she's going to get married in June. And I think... Well, Grace might go to the wedding or might not, we don't know, but I'll be going to the wedding. And she invited me and some of her classmates from a class that she took in her freshman year. Her spouse-to-be is an assistant pastor, and I haven't met him. But he said to her, well, why don't you ask... Well, she told me this. He said, why don't you ask Brickhouse to do a reading? And Rachel said... And I said to him, oh, I don't think he'll want to do that because he's an atheist. And I'm quite glad that she said this, because when she told the story, I said, oh, I'd be happy to do a reading. I'm not that kind of atheist. And to be honest, I was kind of surprised that she didn't already know that. And so then there was a sort of back and forth in which, you know, afterwards the next day she said, yeah, we'd really like you to do it, but I don't want you to do it if you feel uncomfortable. And I wrote back and I said, well, I'd really like to do it, but I don't want to do it unless you really want me to, and whatever. And that went on for a bit. It was like English, you know, English people, when you walk into a lamppost, you apologize to it. It felt like sort of one of those kinds of stories. Anyway, so maybe from those stories you can tell a little bit about what kind of an atheist I am. And I'll tell you another thing that will maybe be revealing about my background. So, as you can tell, I don't come from the United States. I come from somewhere else. And I moved here in the mid-1980s. And I was really quite bemused by American culture in all sorts of ways. And there was a news story, I think, on NPR about a lawsuit which really got me troubled. And this was the background. There were some football players at a public high school, I don't know where, maybe in Texas, who'd been praying in the end zone. I don't really know what the end zone is, but whatever it is, they were praying in it during a game. I mean, presumably not while the action was going on. That seems sort of self-defeating. But I've since learned that football, basically, most of the time, they're just standing still, watching, you know, and people are shouting at them. That seems to be the game. And someone was suing the school district to try and get it to prohibit them from doing so, from doing this praying in the end zone. And so here was my reaction as I was hearing the story. So my first reaction was, well, I'm really surprised and actually kind of impressed that football players openly mock religion. during their football games. It struck me as surprising. Like, where I come from, athletes tend to be sort of apolitical, they tend to not do controversial things, and I thought, you know, really, really sort of vituperatively mocking Christianity was surprising. And of course, I also thought it was wrong, because I know there probably are some people who mock religion, but I don't mock religion. I don't come from a culture where religion gets mocked a lot. I don't really like it. It's not something I'd encourage. On the other hand, my third reaction was, it's a bit heavy-handed for the church to try and get the courts in here to force the schools to prohibit mocking religion. And so I thought, well, I guess I'm opposed to it. Like, if they want to mock religion in the end zone, that's their business. Even though I can understand why people might want to stop them. Now, I was then absolutely horrified when I found out what the story was really about. So there were two things. So first, it was the civil libertarians and not the church that was trying to get the mockery prohibited. But the other thing was, nobody understood this was mockery. Everybody seemed to think that this praying in the end zone, including the ones who were doing it, was actually religious as opposed to sacrilegious, which is what, to me, obviously, it was. They really thought that it was somehow religious to call upon God to support a particular team in a football game. Their particular team. Like, I can kind of understand if you're praying, you know, you think God, oh, he should support somebody else's football team. Well, you know, that's sort of one thing. But that they thought it was okay to call upon God to support theirs, I thought was a bit much. And it was then that I knew that I really wasn't in Kansas anymore. And then I remembered I wasn't even from Kansas in the first place. You can tell from that story that there's a sort of cultural difference between the way, or maybe between the way religion sort of plays a role in my life and in the country I come from than here. So I grew up in a country and at a time when the relationship between religious and secular discourse was much more seamless than it is now there, and than it has been, as far as I can tell, forever here. So in Britain, for example, you know, politicians, in Alistair Campbell's words, don't do religion. When Tony Blair wanted to make a big deal of himself being a Christian in public, Alistair Campbell says, nope, you're not doing that. That will lose you votes, it will lose you support, and it will make you look ridiculous. Whereas here, people who are not Christians make a big deal of being Christians in their public commentary. If you're religious, you're religious, and it might be an important part of your private identity and even your public identity, but you don't make a big deal of it. I just was listening yesterday to one of the candidates, the most left-wing candidate for the leadership of the British Labour Party, which, as you probably know, has, you know, sort of shifted very far to the left recently. And Becky Long Bailey is the sort of, she's the successor candidate for the socialist position. She was being interviewed about her Catholicism. She's a church-going Roman Catholic. She has pretty standard Roman Catholic views about things, and she is a left-wing socialist, and nobody thinks there's anything sort of weird about that. The only thing they think is weird is that you'd make a big deal of it. There are no votes in being religious there, or in being anti-religious. And at least there used to be a sort of rough expectation that you live your life reasonably well, and you can give reasons for whatever claims that you make and whatever policies you commit to. That said, the labor movement, and I grew up sort of in and around the labor movement, it's an important sort of part of my life, and the socialist movement in particular, if you grew up in that kind of environment, almost all of the heroes that you grew up were in fact Christians. So the leadership of the, the two great leaders of the left wing of the Labour Party, the socialist wing of the Labour Party in my childhood were Tony Benn, who was a teetotal, regular church-going Methodist, and Eric Heffer, who was not at all a teetotal, regular church-going Roman Catholic. My oldest, knowing that somebody is a Christian in the UK, knowing that they're evangelical, tells you nothing about what their politics are. So you can't predict anything about what they're going to say about taxes, what they're going to say about the welfare state, what they're going to say about foreign policy. They're probably more likely to be anti-war pacifists than average. My oldest friend and my oldest cousin are both evangelical born-again Christians. My friend has never voted and would never vote conservative, and my cousin is a very left-wing socialist, and they're both considered, they're not considered weird. I mean, I'll just tell you, my friend is weird. But, you know, his weirdness has nothing to do with any of this. So being Christian or being roughly Christian was normal in my environment. So, my friends and apparently my cousins are Christian. So why am I not? So I'll talk about why I'm not, and then I'll talk about why it's slightly misleading to say I'm not. So if you do believe in God or a God, it must be for one or, you know, there are one of two reasons for that. So one is that you have some sort of personal experience or revelation or sense that enables you to have faith despite the absence of any good reasons or any good arguments, any good sort of rational reasons or arguments. And I don't have that. And I'm not going to ridicule or look down on those who do. I'll talk to you later about why that is. But if you don't have it, you don't have it. So if you don't have it, what you need is for there to be good enough arguments for you to believe in God, actual sort of rational arguments. And I do remember a lot about my life, probably more than I would like to, but I honestly don't remember whether I ever thought there were good arguments for the existence of God or a God. If I did, I haven't done for as long as I remember. Because they all the arguments I ever do here seem to contain flaws serious enough to reject them, which is not to say that you shouldn't believe in God, because you might have faith, and faith can be completely reasonable. I don't think there are great arguments for the non-existence of God either, because if there were, then faith should be rejected, but I don't think there are. But something else became important to me in my teens, and I don't think I heard this argument anywhere, but it was an argument that really I found very compelling about why you didn't need to think about whether you believed in God or not. It's a kind of reverse or version of Pascal's wager, that's what I would have thought if I'd known what it was. So now I just tell you a bit about Pascal's. You all know what Pascal's wager is, right? I mean, maybe in case anybody doesn't. So Pascal's wager was, maybe I've even written it down here. God exists, then believing in God will save you. If God doesn't exist, then believing in God will do you no harm. Therefore, you should believe in God, right? It's a sort of rational argument. And my father-in-law claims, I don't know whether I really believe him, to believe in God on the basis of Pascal's wager. And every time he says this to me, I point out the deep flaw in Pascal's wager. And he says, oh yes, I never thought of that. Which is not at all true, because he did think of it last time I told him what the flaw was, and the time before that. So actually he's thought about it many, many times. He just forgets, either conveniently or because he really is losing it, I can't tell. And the fatal flaw, which my father-in-law thinks of whenever I point it out, is, what if God condemns those who believe in God in response to Pascal's wager? If so, then believing him on the basis of Pascal's wager, you're screwed. He says, oh yeah, I never thought of that. I look at him and I think, it's time for another margarita. Really, if you've read about the capricious and contrary God about whom the Old Testament is written, it should have occurred to you that God, this argument might have occurred to you. So my argument, I thought, relieved me of the need. So my argument, the one I'm going to tell you about, relieved me of the need to decide whether to believe in God. And it was just this. So if there is a God, and he or she or it is good, then he or she or it wants us to live a good life, and does not want us to worship him, her, or it, right? So if there is a God and it's good, then you don't have to believe in it and you don't have to worship it. if there is a God and he or she or it makes belief in and worship of him any kind of condition for salvation, then God's really bad and not worthy of our worship or of our belief. And if such a God exists, well, we're all screwed anyway. So I kind of, that's why I'm not a Christian. I'm not a Christian because I don't have the faith, and I kind of figured out I didn't need to think about whether I should have the faith or not. But why am I not, this is, I just tell you, they gave me 50 minutes. I'm not going to take 50 minutes. I'm surprised by this. But why am I not exactly a Christian? So why did I put not exactly in the... Oh, they didn't put the title up, that's good. So the title was Why I'm Not, and then in parentheses, exactly a Christian. So here are two thoughts. The first is that Jesus, in the Gospels, gets morality just about exactly right. So people over prophets and over prophets... kindness, community, universalism, distrust of ethnic, religious, racial, national bonds and divides, humility, intellectual and personal, distrust of wealth and its pursuit, egalitarianism, I'll come back to this, everybody counts for just as much as everybody else, sacrifice, not for its own sake, but for the sake of those we have reason to care about, priority to the vulnerable and the disadvantaged, compassion, empathy. Shall I read that passage from Matthew or not? I shall. I'm afraid I didn't print it out, so I've got to look at it on my computer. Sorry, I don't have to look it up. It should be there. And I got the New International Version. I'm sorry for those of you who prefer the King James, which I do, but I just went for the... Then the king will say to those on his right, come you who are blessed by my father, take your inheritance, the kingdom prepared for you since the creation of the world. For I was hungry and you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger and you invited me in. I needed clothes and you clothed me. I was sick and you looked after me. I was in prison and you came to visit me. And then the righteous will answer him, Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you something to drink? When did we see you a stranger and invite you in, or needing clothes and clothe you? When did we see you sick or in prison and go to visit you? And the king will reply, truly I tell you, whatever you did for one of the least of these brothers and sisters of mine, you did for me. So I think you can imagine that our current president is really going to have a hard time if there are some pearly gates when he gets there. Now, you don't have to be a Christian to understand or embrace the value of all these things and how much better a life grounded in them is than a life which rejects or simply ignores them. But it's striking how rare we see this concatenation of values. And it's a good job you don't need to be a Christian to believe in all those things, because I do, and I'm not a Christian, right? But it's striking how rare we see this sort of concatenation of values embraced prior to the emergence of Christianity. And in particular, the deep egalitarian commitment that Christianity embraces, that every single person is equal in the eyes of God. Or in its secular version, that there every person has equal value that we are obliged to acknowledge and respect in our individual actions and in our collective actions. It's really new. And Jesus derogates tribal ties really self-consciously and explicitly. That's the point of the parable of the Good Samaritan. The point of the parable of the Good Samaritan is not go and be nice to people who are in trouble, though absolutely you should. It's the Good Samaritan was a Samaritan. We despise the Samaritans, but the Samaritan was good. We should not be despising the Samaritans. We have no right to despise them, because those who are different from us, they are not despisable, because they are good too. I don't want to insult, I guess, there's only one person I know here who does believe the things that I might be about to insult her for believing, so I'm going to try not to insult, but, you know, my great hero, Clement Attlee, the greatest peacetime Prime Minister of Britain, was once asked whether he was a Christian, and he said, Well, I accept the deep teachings of Jesus. I just don't believe any of the mumbo-jumbo, which was his way of saying, I'm not exactly a Christian. So the first thought was really about morality, and it was really about the gift that I think Christianity gave to us, but that Islam also embraces, of egalitarianism. And it's a gift that is realized in many of the Christian sects, especially the Protestant sects, that emerged, you know, over the course of, you know, around 400 or 500, and subsequently. The second thought is about the particular role that Protestantism played in the history of Western societies and Western culture. So Luther was not the first Protestant. Throughout church history, there have been many egalitarian dissenters, and Luther's protests were just the first to really catch fire internationally, which is not totally coincidentally related to the invention of the printing press. Well, indeed, because of the invention of the printing press, is were the first to catch fire internationally. And the Protestant idea throughout all these iterations was just this. We each have a relationship to God. We're each responsible for our own salvation. And the relationship that we have to God is not rightly mediated by authority figures like the priest or like the Pope. The translation of the Bible into the vernacular is one of the great moments of the past 2,000 years, because it's the moment when it becomes possible for those who can speak the vernacular, and eventually those who can read the vernacular, to scrutinize God's commands, to scrutinize the church's demands on their own, and not simply have to rely on the authority of the priests. And once you have that, of course, a single totalitarian church can no longer run things. And eventually, totalitarian governments can no longer run things. The word of God is to be interpreted by each of us, so it must be translated into the vernacular, accessible to all, not held back by the priests, because we must each answer for ourselves. And that idea that we must each answer for ourselves is sort of a deep feature of, it's sort of the founding idea, that along with egalitarianism, is the founding idea of Western liberalism, Western socialism, the ideal of a free society. It's right there in the intellectual background whenever we think about these things. So, again, you don't have to be a Christian to embrace this idea, and it's a good thing too, because I'm not a Christian and I do embrace this idea. But again, like egalitarianism, I sort of think of it as Christianity's intellectual gift to us. This is the Free Thought Festival, right? Free thought. That idea is the underpinning idea of free thought, of free thinkers. And when people talked about themselves as free thinkers, they did not necessarily mean they were atheists. They meant that they were thinking for themselves and together with others, not thinking what the priests had told them to think. So I'll finish with a final thought, not having used up my time, which is good. But it's a really long thought, so it's okay. I'll carry on for, you know, you'll be tired by the end of it. So I said earlier that I wouldn't ridicule or look down on those who have a faith in God. And sometimes when you say, I won't ridicule somebody for something, it sounds like you're congratulating yourself for their forbearance. They merit ridicule, but I'm such a decent person that I can control myself. It's just like when you say, I don't mean to criticize you for, and what you mean is, yeah, I'm going to... Whenever somebody says, I don't mean to criticize you, you know they're about to criticize you, right? But that's not at all my thought. It's something really different. So I, too, have some faith, and some of the stuff I have faith with is stuff that science can't explain, science can't observe, science can't evaluate or help us to evaluate. In fact, you know, when it comes to believing in God, at least there could be observable evidence for it, right? So, I mean, I challenge you. if every time you did something bad, you said, "May God strike me with lightning," and every time you said that, lightning struck you, after the fifth or sixth time, you'd stop thinking this was coincidence. I mean, and after the tenth time, I mean, you should start worrying. I mean, after the tenth time, you're probably dead, but, you know. And actually, the stuff I have faith in, I don't think I can give, you know, I don't think I have those sorts of possible verification conditions. So what I do believe in is objective, real, moral or ethical standards. Now, I think you do too. So I believe that what the Nazis did was wrong. And what Nick Winton did when he saved hundreds of Jewish children on the Kinder transport, and when he did that, he did something good and right. And when Mildred Fish Harnack, after whom my chair in philosophy is named, risked and ultimately gave her life in service of the resistance to Nazism, she was acting well and rightly. So when somebody says the Holocaust was morally bad, or when somebody says Mildred Fish Harnack exhibited moral excellence, they're saying something that is true. There's an objective fact built into the fabric of the world, though not a natural physical, not the natural physical fabric of the world, not part of the fabric that scientific method was designed to help us describe and explain, that makes it true. And the moral standards by which we can evaluate the claims that I have just made are just as real as the evidentiary standards that we use in science, but they're not physically real. I think we're equipped with reasoning powers that help us get to some access to the truths and falsehoods about those standards. Some are easy to see, and in some situations it's easy to apply them. Some are much harder to see, and in some situations it's really hard to apply them. And I think a lot of moral questions, it's really, really difficult to get the answer to, of course, until we develop the scientific method. Basically, all scientific questions were really, really difficult to get the answer to. And even now, the interesting ones, you know, there are lots of interesting ones that are difficult. But they are real, and I can't make sense of the world without them. And this is the thing. I can show you, most of you, that if you're being reasonable and intellectually honest, you already believe things that commit you to something like what I believe about this. But if you're determined not to agree, I can't convince you. I don't have a knockdown argument for the existence of these moral standards, these objective standards. And it's different from what Attlee called the mumbo jumbo, but my stance toward it is much like the stance of Christians toward what Attlee calls the mumbo jumbo. And in the Gospels, although Jesus, who being a prophet and not a philosopher, makes declarations rather than arguments, and his declarations are typically opaque and often, though not in the case of the one I read, require a degree of interpretation. And although Jesus himself may not have said many of the things that are attributed to him in the Gospels, what is attributed to him gets things remarkably right about morality. At least so it seems when we do our best to apply our powers of moral reasoning as well as we can. So I'm not in a position to say, look, you have faith in the mumbo jumbo and I don't have faith in anything like that. No, I have faith in something different from but relevantly like the mumbo jumbo. I believe in the existence of things that I can't prove the existence of either with reason or with science. I think you do too. So, although I'm not a Christian, and I'm not a Christian because I don't believe there is a God, I'm only not exactly a Christian, and I'm fine with that. And that's it. If I were really skilled, I'd get you to talk amongst yourselves. I'd have come with some questions for you to think about at the table, but I haven't. Go ahead and ask.
So you said you have certain objective moral values that will require
I think so. I think I could go back and, you know, many of the standards that I think are true are, so for example, people who put weight when they're considering how to act on the fact that somebody else is of the same national origin as them is doing something wrong. I do think murder's wrong too, just to be clear. So a long list of principles I could give you.
So the question is it a single standard or just a basket of standards or values?
I think at the very highest level of abstraction, which I don't think is particularly useful, there may be only a few. Mm-hmm. Being a philosopher, I like to think that there are only a few things rather than many. But at the level at which we actually have to do our practical reasoning, I think there are quite a lot. And they have to be, you know, and of course the job of a moral philosopher is to show, or is to figure out how they hang together. And I can do that with some of the things in the basket, but not really with others.
The things that I guess are in Christianity that you object to?
So we have to use our reason. So we have to use, you know, what we do is we use our imperfect moral reasoning and we do it together. I think that as individuals, there are all sorts of things that left to ourselves as individuals, we're not very good at thinking about. And I actually think morality is one of those. We look at principles, we look at judgments about cases, we try and figure out when they're inconsistent. When they're inconsistent, the great thing about inconsistency, I don't recommend it, but the great thing about it is if you've got an inconsistency, you know you've got a falsehood. Figuring out what the falsehoods are, that's the real work. And you do that by, you know, one thing you do is you think about what the causes are of your belief in those things. So you should always be, any moral belief you have that is self-interested, it still might be true, but you should be suspicious of it, right? Any moral belief you have that you have simply because your parents taught it to you. I'm sure your parents were lovely. But any belief that the only thing that you can give is that they taught it to you, you should be a bit suspicious of it. And what you do is you look for people who disagree with you and you look for people who are, you know, are reasonable and thoughtful and with whom you can communicate but who disagree with you, and you try to have, you know, as carefully as possible and as reasonably as possible, a dialogue through which you try and learn from their experience, they try and learn from yours. That is the best method, I think, that we have. And as I say, this is much less sophisticated than the scientific method that we sort of hit upon about 400, 500 years ago. I like to say the British, you know, we gave the world three things: science, the Beatles, and cricket. And, you know, some might say that makes up for us stealing stuff from all over the world. But you know, the scientific method is really pretty sophisticated, and what I've described to you isn't. But it's the best, I think it's the best we've got. I don't think you should take Jesus' word for it. That's really important.
So robust epistemological.
Yeah. Well, robust is too strong. Less robust than we would like, epistemological tools. Yeah. Go ahead.
If you were a judge in a, let's say, a murder court, and the defendant was explaining why they did some horrible act, and but they went through the process, it makes perfect sense why they did this. You know, this person she had been bothering me for 10 years. And within that person's idea, it makes perfect moral sense why they did that. And as a judge, after listening to that, and with your own morality, what might you say to that person why they were wrong? Especially since reporters may be coming up to you, where in their mind, it's a perfect one thing.
Yeah.
Why are you prosecuting me? Because what I did was makes perfect moral sense.
So let me just distinguish between two different cases. So in one case, they're really right. So in one case, what they did made perfect moral sense. Actually, and they're right about that. So I can imagine cases like that. And what I would say, I mean, I don't know that I would say this in public. I'd be a judge, right? But I think in that case, what I would say in my head, yeah, that did make perfect moral sense. And we live, and the rule of law is extremely important. And one of the things you do, when you do things that are illegal, you know, the risk you take, and sometimes it's just right that you accept the legal consequences, even though what you did made perfect moral sense. And I can imagine, you know, I really can imagine cases where I hope the law would be forgiving, but there are some cases where, no, the law is just going to say you're going to get punished for that, even though it made perfect moral sense. In the normal case, it didn't make perfect moral sense. They've made a mistake in their reasoning somewhere. They've misidentified the truth in some way. Again, I'd be a judge, so I don't know how well I'd want to get into this, you know? That's the great thing about philosophers. It's my profession as being a philosopher, and one of the great things about it is I don't need to know the law, you know? And I don't play some sort of role. But I would try and identify the flaw in the moral reasoning. But even when people do the right thing, I think we've got really good reasons for enforcing the law. You know, the law can never be designed in a way that captures everything exactly right. And I think maintaining the law is important when the law is reasonably just, which at least our laws with respect to murder are reasonably just. They're not wholly just, but reasonably just. So I still, you know, I wouldn't be leaving my job as a judge in that case. Go ahead.
Yes, I did hear that the younger generation probably isn't going to church, or if they're not Christian anymore, that it's really going down. But at the same time, there's a big belief in astrology and magic. Can you explain the connection between the two, if you can? And I don't know if this is a proper question to ask.
No, so actually my dad once said this to me, and so my dad, I have in common with my dad loads of stuff. So we're both atheists. We both have best friends from childhood who are evangelical Christian ministers. I was the best man. I just tell you, being the best man at an evangelical Christian wedding is interesting. And my dad's best friend was best man at his wedding. And my dad said, you know, the thing, there's this big difference between when he was growing up and when I was growing up. He said, because, you know, when people, by and large, the messages he got about how to live were from the church, and the people who gave those messages believed them. And by and large, the messages that my children get about how to live are not from the church. They're from Nike, and they're from, you know, what's his name, that awful man in Facebook, Zuckerman. Zuckerberg, yeah, or whatever. And they don't believe them, right? I mean, basically, you know, commercial messages are how to live by people who don't believe that's the way to live. Of course, I think astrology is nonsense, just to be very clear. I think most astrology is fraudulent. Now, you might think most Christianity is fraudulent. I don't. But, yeah, if you do, like, you know, I think most Christian ministers, even ones who, you know, bizarrely support, we live in this sort of bizarre world where we have this guy who, if you were a Democrat, would be the Antichrist, but being a Republican is somehow somebody we are supposed to vote for. But I think people basically are talking in good faith. I think most astrologers are not. I think that astrology makes lots of claims that are clearly verifiable or falsifiable according to the scientific method, and they're made in that way. They're made as if they are scientific claims, right? They're straightforwardly empirical claims. I don't think that the claims about morality are empirical. I don't think the claim that God exists is really an empirical claim. I mean, it's empirical in some sense, and I did give you a sort of story about that. So I do think they're really quite different. Astrology is demonstrably false, or that its claims are. The claim that God exists, I don't think, is demonstrably false. All right, sorry, I rambled a bit, but I'm trying to distinguish the two. Don't believe in astrology, it's... Don't believe in it. It's... Oh, why are they believing in it? Goodness knows why people believe in what they believe in. Right? You know, why don't you guys all love cricket? I don't know. It's sort of some sort of deep defect in... you shouldn't insult your audience. I don't have a good answer to that. Young people, there are some young people here. What's your answer? Go ahead.
Because it's fun.
Because it's fun, yeah. Yeah. That seems a good reason to love cricket. I'm not so sure it's a good reason to believe in astrology, but yeah. At the back. The courses that I currently teach on campus. So I teach one large lecture course called Contemporary Moral Issues, which I teach just about every spring. I don't know what you mean, what you would mean by large, but currently it's about 150 students. Normally it's sort of more like 80 to 100. So that's one course I teach. Right now I'm teaching another course, which I teach occasionally and is much smaller, though not small enough, on justice and education, where we think... one of the things I think about a lot is education policy and values in education. I teach a freshman class called... what's it called? Children, Marriage, and the Family. Good. Every 3 years I teach a freshman course called Children, Marriage, and the Family. I sometimes teach Love, Sex, and Friendship, because it's got three words in it as well, just like Children, Marriage, and the Family, and they sort of follow along. So I like the students who took Children, Marriage, and the Family to take Love, Sex, and Friendship, because then they've got all six. But seriously, I do teach that actually specifically sometimes for the Children, Marriage, and the Family. And I teach a political philosophy course and an ethics course, both of which are sort of designed for philosophy majors, but which the way I teach them, this is probably less true of the ethics course and more true of the political philosophy course. I hope that anybody who's really interested and willing to, you know, make the effort will be able to, you know, flourish in them. So that's sort of... I do not teach anything about religion, that's not true. I've got two colleagues who occasionally teach philosophy of religion. If you haven't invited Larry Shapiro to... Have you had Larry Shapiro in the past? You should have him speak at one of these events. He has a brilliant book about... You may think writing a whole book about why you shouldn't believe in miracles is kind of a bit of an effort, but it is genuinely a really good book about why you shouldn't believe in miracles. He doesn't believe there are any. Obviously, he doesn't believe in them. He doesn't believe there are any, but he believes even if there were some, you shouldn't believe in them. So he's got this really elegant argument for that. Go ahead.
How much do you incorporate neuroscience and then like psychology in terms of like defense mechanisms and cognitive errors in terms of when you're talking about these types of issues?
One of the things when you're thinking about... So I tend to think professionally more about political philosophy than about ethics. I mean, so ethics is broader and political philosophy is narrower, and that's why I said to you, you know, I can talk really sensibly about part of this and less sensibly about the rest. But even when you're thinking about political philosophy, so I think it's proper to think that one of the constraints on a correct theory of morality or you know, political values is that it must be livable by the kind of beings we actually are. And the kinds of beings we actually are the kinds of beings that have all sorts of sort of bounded rationalities, right? And we are emotional in various ways. We're not purely rational, and that's a great thing, by the way. As a matter of sort of method in doing philosophy about these things, sensitivity to the whatever the truth is about the kinds of beings we are is really important, sort of the psychological truth. And I say the truth because, psychology is still an emerging science. You know, the last 5 years we've been discovering that a lot of the, I think philosophy is a little bit embarrassed by this, because I'd say in the past 25 years there's been a lot of attention to the findings of social psychologists in particular, and some philosophical work builds in assumptions that are drawn from the social psychological literature, and some of those assumptions are now very questionable. I mean, I think there really is a crisis in social psychology, a crisis of replication, and I think what we're discovering is that they haven't, as a profession, they have not paid, you know, they've not really done their due diligence, and so certainly I, it's not that I think anything that has been claimed over the past 25 years is false, it's just that I no longer have a lot of confidence in lots of those things. So think about, for example, the literature around implicit bias. So, you know, the literature around implicit bias, so implicit bias is a form of bounded rationality, people aren't aware of it, and I still believe there is implicit bias. I still believe we're all susceptible to it, but the literature on it is not, you know, I do not feel confident in the literature on it in a way that I think we all felt confident in the literature on it 5 years ago. So yes, we do pay attention, but we ought to be quite careful in the attention we pay to that, kind of, those kinds of findings.
Yeah. You said social psychology.
Behavior. Social psychology is the psychology of how we interact with each other. The implicit bias literature is an example of. I can't give you the exact boundaries of, and you know, behavioral psychology and social psychology overlap, but they're not identical. And it is not a Britishism, although I'm very prone to Britishisms, I will say, including ones that are archaic, because I left in 1986 and nobody told me that you can't say jolly good chap anymore, you know? So I carry on saying it. go ahead.
So, if you had the ability to kind of force every student here to take either a course or a set of subtopics within philosophy, what would you want that to be?
Definitely not logic. Just so that you, I think the two things that really I would like everybody to do. So one, yeah, I mean, one is, you know, one is some form of applied ethics. I mean, that sounds totally, you know, of course, that's what I teach, so that it would be. There's another class that my colleague Fareed Masroor teaches that I think is probably more valuable if taught well, which he does, but also if taught, I think the problem with it is it's not taught to enough people. And it's a, I don't know what we call it. I think we probably call it something like informal logic. I know that I've been places where it's called that, but it's not logic at all. It's about fallacies. It's about how do I identify in the reasoning of others and your own, you know, bad reasoning, essentially, and how to do it in a way that, you know, logic is all formal, and the problem is that, yeah, of course, if you do logic, then you're good at this formal reasoning, but it turns out that being good in formal reasoning doesn't just then translate into being good at actual reasoning. Otherwise, all these people who are good at math would be good at everything else too, which, with all due respect, many of them aren't. Hannah, I exempt you completely from that. But actual sort of explicit instruction in how to identify when the wool is being pulled over your eyes, how to think better about probabilistic claims, how to identify your own biases and the biases of others. I think that would be really, and I think we have a lot of resources for doing that, that, for example, psychologists, although they know all this stuff, don't have in pedagogical resources. So that's what I'd really like people to do.
E-project?
Yeah, maybe that's right. Maybe I should fight to get that as one of the gen ed requirements that everybody has to meet. And that would at least enable us to hire about 50 more people in the philosophy department. But some people might not think that's a good thing. But
cut down on the blue.